This is The Takeaway for Friday, December 22nd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Lawmakers bounded for the exits last night on Capitol Hill, rushing home for the Christmas holiday with their families. And they had a busy week. Wednesday, it was $1.5 trillion in unfinanced tax cuts tilted heavily toward corporations and the wealthy. Then Thursday, before the Christmas rush, a temporary stopgap spending measure designed to keep the government open, no shutdown, with no permanent funding for the then expired Children's Health Insurance Program.
So what we're doing here today is basically saying, wealthy Americans, big fat Christmas present for you. Tiny Tim, we're taking your crutch away from you and all the other kids in this country.
That's California Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier this week. Jackie Speier is frustrated, and she's not the only one on Capitol Hill. Congressional leaders promised they would find permanent five-year funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, otherwise known as CHIP. 9 million kids and pregnant women from low-income families are covered by CHIP. Meanwhile, we've been following this story since the beginning of October when CHIP expired, and now states have resorted to warning beneficiaries that their kids could lose health coverage if Congress doesn't act. Well, some temporary funding is all those states and families can rely on now. And Republicans and Democrats are promising that the program will be renewed if everyone waits just a little longer. Jeffrey Young is senior reporter for HuffPost. He's here in the studio with me. We're also joined by Aaron Miller, vice president of health initiatives for Colorado Children's Campaign. They're a nonprofit, nonpartisan research and advocacy organization. Aaron, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeff, thank you for being here, too.
My pleasure.
Jeff, there is broad support for the CHIP program in Congress. Republicans say they support it. Democrats say they love it. But it expired in October. What's going on? Why no permanent funding for this program that everybody says they're for?
Yeah, it's crazy because no one actually wants this program to go away. The problem they have not been able to solve is how to finance it, because unlike the tax cuts, they're insisting on paying for this program. CHIP says about $16 billion a year for this program, most of which comes to the federal government, like 90% or so is federal money.
Sorry, let me stop you. Say that again. $1.5 trillion in tax cuts were not paid for. This $16 billion a year must be paid for.
That's the way the Congress is going about it.
Okay.
And that's been the norm when this program has been renewed every 5 years. the dispute here is how to pay for it. In the Senate, they never passed a bill, but the one that came out of the committee that oversees the program didn't have any mechanism of paying for it. Over in the House, they basically dinged the Affordable Care Act and raised Medicare premiums for some really wealthy people and a few other things to pay for it. Democrats object to those pay-fors. You know, one of the sources of money is a program from the Affordable Care Act that provides grants for things like anti-obesity programs in grade schools. And they're sort of taking money out of that to pay for CHIP.
All right. So Congress did pass some temporary funding when they headed for the doors last night. What exactly does CHIP get to rely on for now?
Remember that $16 billion number I just quoted? Congress passed on Thursday night, the wee hours Friday morning, I forget exactly when, is just shy of $3 billion. And that's meant to cover 6 months of the program. Now, that includes the past 2 months and then all the way through March. You see the discrepancy there. $16 billion program, $2.85 billion, I believe, enacted before. So this doesn't really it's not clear that this alleviates the pressure on the states. It's certainly better than nothing because there were a few states that were about to shut down the programs completely, kick the kids right off because they didn't have the money. But that could still happen at some point during the next few months.
Well, Aaron, you're there in one of the states. You've been warning in Colorado that the state has been running on fumes, essentially, and that because Congress let CHIP lapse, up to 90,000 kids and pregnant women in Colorado could start losing benefits. What's going on around your way?
Yeah, I think it's just a really tough situation here in Colorado. As you mentioned, our reserves that we had to sort of keep this program going are nearly tapped. And we know that families need some warning. This is a big change in family finances. So we definitely want to give families enough warning to plan as much as they can, to do whatever they can to try to get their kid covered. But it's a really tough situation. And Colorado is one of the minority of states that actually provides coverage not just for kids but also for pregnant women through this program. And so those pregnant women, I mean, there are pregnant women with due dates in February and March, and they're wondering if their health insurance is going to be there for them when they really need it. And that kind of stress, it's not good for pregnant women. It's not good for young kids. This is just a really tough way to sort of run an insurance program here, sort of like month by month. It's hard for the state. It's hard for budgeting. It's hard for our program. And it's hard for these families.
I mean, insurance programs by definition run on predictability, and this is not predictability, Aaron. A couple of months of temporary funding, has that done anything to alleviate the anxiety and the stress from pregnant women, from patients, from families that you're talking about? I doubt they're following the day-to-day, minute-to-minute maneuverings of Congress. They probably just suspect this program isn't funded.
Yeah, I think so. Part of the problem is with, you know, as Jeff was talking about, we don't know the funding that was approved by Congress isn't as much as you would expect to sort of spend over this period. So we don't know how much, if any, of that funding is going to come to Colorado. We don't have a great sense for how long that will allow us to continue our program here. The state has approved an emergency sort of stopgap measure, sort of a Band-Aid. So the state has said that if the federal government falls short and we are short on funding for February, we will continue this program with state funds in the month of February. And that guarantee means that we're going to delay sending out termination letters. So termination letters in the state of Colorado, we were planning to send those out the day after Christmas to start generating those letters. So that would have been a really tough thing for families to start getting next week. And so, you know, we have this sort of emergency stopgap measure here that will allow us to delay those letters until the end of January. But it's getting really tight.
Jeff, does all this sound familiar to you, the anxiety in Colorado and sort of the shell game accounting that people are resorting to?
Yeah, and this is exactly what I heard from parents I spoke to over the last week or so whose kids are on these programs. You know, and part of it, too, is that, okay, if CHIP's going to go away, if you knew that for sure, you can start looking into other options. You know, maybe you get your kids on your insurance policy that maybe you're getting from the health insurance exchanges. States also, and this is time-consuming and really complicated, but if there's no CHIP, in a lot of states, they could move those kids onto Medicaid so they would have something. Same thing with pregnant women. But you can't plan for any of this when you don't know when your state's going to run out of money, if at all. And Colorado and a few other states may have, you know, a little bit of money lying around that they can use to like keep this thing going a little bit, to patch it. But a lot of states simply don't have that money. They're not talking about state money in Alabama, for example, where they've already told parents, you know, that they're going to shut that before Congress passed this new funding bill. I don't know what they're going to say now, but they already told parents, sorry, but, you know, by February, your kids are going to be uninsured.
Aaron, if a letter like that goes out, and it sounds like you were on the cusp of it in Colorado, what does it mean to a family of a sick kid or a pregnant mom to get a letter to say your benefits could be cut off? I mean, that's got to give them a great deal of anxiety.
Yeah, and so to be clear, those letters have already gone out in Colorado that you might be losing your health insurance coverage. So we wanted to give families 60-day notice. So we sent those letters at the end of November, said you might lose your health insurance coverage. You know, be sure you get into the doctor, get your kid into the dentist. You know, giving families time to sort of get those appointments scheduled and start thinking about what might come next. So the letters that we're planning to, you know, go out at the end of this month would have been coverage termination letters. So that would have been the official sort of letter families would have needed to then try to get on their insurance plan at work or to try to get on an insurance plan through the state health exchange. So it was really, you know, it was the sort of ticket for those families to get into other sorts of coverage. It was that proof of a qualifying life event. And so, you know, we're not sending those termination letters now. Those letters will go out now based on what we know so far. Those letters will go out at the end of January. Those letters would have meant that families would have started getting into other coverage if they could.
This is just an enormous amount of will we, won't we, what do we do for an insurance program that people are supposed to be able to rely upon. I mean, that's the whole point. Jeff, let's kick this forward now to the new year. There's government funding now through January 19th, a new threat of a government shutdown when they come back. They're going to have to do some big deals to keep the government open. DACA is going to be a big one. Defense spending, all those big items. CHIP is in the mix now. Does this get thrown in with the big deals that Congress has to do? And are we likely to see a fix by Valentine's Day?
Well, I mean, Congress has said that you know, this has been a priority for them the entire time, since even before the program expired at the end of September. And they're still saying that. But, you know, if I'm a state official or if my kid's on this program, I've heard this before. And incidentally, you mentioned before, like, oh, maybe people aren't following this minute to minute. You know, this is anecdotal, but the parents I spoke to when reporting a story that earlier this week, they are following this news very, very closely because it's extremely important to them. You know, you think about it, like, here's a program that, like, almost no one opposes and they still can't get it through. They did a little patch a few weeks ago. They just did another one. And you look at that stopgap spending bill, all of these crises that were lurching, you know, from one to the next. And to me, the sort of failure to take care of CHIP is a perfect example of how dysfunctional the Congress is. No one actually opposes this.
Aren't governors getting on the phone and screaming down the phone at senators and lawmakers saying, I'm the governor of this state. I have to administer CHIP. Get it done.
I mean, yeah, that is happening. But I think even the power and influence that the nation's governors have is not enough to fix what's wrong with Congress.
Still, as we look forward to January, where there will be some big government shutdown brinksmanship news, I'm predicting that type of news will happen. Is it likely now that CHIP will be in that mix in January? They have funding through March in that authorization. We wait all the way until early spring or maybe after New Year's?
Honestly, under more normal circumstances, I would say, of course, they're going to fix this. It's health care for children, except that they haven't done it so far, which to me is reason enough to wonder whether it's going to be February 27th and we're going to be having this conversation all over again. Not to mention, again, it's really not clear to me that the money that Congress just passed is enough to get all the way through March.
So we're going to see if the crisis management that comes up in January, and by the way, it is coming, there will be shutdown news in mid-January, whether it includes health care for 9 million children and pregnant women in the CHIP program. Jeff Young, senior reporter for HuffPost, I'm sorry.
That's
rebranded.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for being here. Aaron Miller, thanks to you too, Vice President of Health Initiatives for Colorado Children's Campaign. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
And many, many of you around the country have had direct experience with the Children's Health Insurance Program. We've been hearing from you. From Salt Lake City, Utah, yes, as a single head of a very young family, I had to tap into CHIP and WIC. I was not prepared in any way to be the sole breadwinner for a tiny baby, a toddler, and one preschooler and one kindergartner. And from Philadelphia, when my daughter was born, we relied on CHIP. I don't know what we would have done without it.
Hi, this is Kate. I'm calling from the lovely Harrisonburg, Virginia. If my son hadn't received CHIP when he was younger for his severe asthma and allergies, he probably wouldn't be alive right now. The preventative care and the pediatric pulmonologists that we found have saved his life numerous times and have prevented actually more costs in the future.
We always want to hear from you. Do you have experience with CHIP? Call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stay with us. Two Navy pilots training in their F-18 off the coast of San Diego in 2004, confused, you can hear them bewildered by what they're seeing outside the cockpit. That video was released this past August by the Defense Department, but a lot of people saw it for the first time this past weekend in a report from the New York Times. And that report says that between 2007 and 2012, the Pentagon spent $22 million on the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, investigating reports of, you guessed it, unidentified flying objects. So what exactly was going on at the Pentagon, and what were they hoping to find? Let's try to get to the bottom of this with Don Lincoln. He's an adjunct physics professor at the University of Notre Dame. He's also author of Alien Universe, Extraterrestrials in Our Minds and in the Cosmos. Don, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Does this appear to be a case of extraterrestrials really in the cosmos, or at least in the atmosphere, or purely in the minds of some bureaucrats and planners at the Pentagon?
Well, you know, that's hard to say. I mean, the thing to remember is that people are looking at UFOs, where the operative letter is U. It's unidentified flying objects. These are reports by sober-minded pilots who are, you know, they're not crazy. They should be taken seriously. But we don't know what they are. So I think that's the right way to think of it, is they're simply unidentified and thereby worth investigating.
Our minds immediately go to alien invaders from outer space, but the U just means unidentified. There's something flying and we're not quite sure what it is.
Well, and it might not even be something flying. I mean, you have to remember back in the 50s and 60s, there was a similar project called Project Blue Book, where there were 12,000 reports of people seeing something in the sky, and they were able to reject all but about 700 of them. So it's not even necessarily that there's something there. It could be flashes of light off cockpits. You know, we're just not sure. But the fact that we're not sure means it's a possibly interesting and worth investigating.
Well, Don, the video clip that we played at the top there is one that millions of Americans have seen by now. It shocked a lot of people. It surprised them. What did you make of it when you saw it?
It's interesting. I'm intrigued by it. I can't tell you what it is because it is, in fact, unidentified. But it's also grainy. It's low resolution. You know, I mean, I from a scientific point of view, I'd want more evidence before I'd conclude anything on it.
More evidence might be what the Pentagon was after if they steered $22 million toward investigating phenomena like this. Money well spent, as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you have to remember, I mean, $22 million sounds like an awful lot of money to you and me, and of course it is, but it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the Pentagon's budget. And the Pentagon, I mean, they're tasked with, you know, keeping us safe, and that means investigating anything that could be, you know, of concern. Now, I would be terribly shocked if these things that they had seen were some kind of super weapon or some extraterrestrial. I really don't believe that's likely, but it would be irresponsible for them not to at least investigate. And this is a fairly modest cost.
Are there other examples maybe that you can think of times when the government or researchers have thrown money at a problem that seemed esoteric or not worth discovering, but led to something important?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, certainly there's an awful lot of research that is done that just sounds really, really crazy. I mean, people have gotten money for, like, you know, the mating habits of mosquitoes, which sounds utterly insane. But if you can figure that out, then you might be able to control the population of mosquitoes, thereby reducing malaria in places where it's possible. So the point is that we don't know what we don't know, and we don't know what will come of this. My prediction is that it's probably mostly explainable things that people were unable to explain, but ultimately are explainable. But I absolutely think it's worth looking into.
Can we talk about something that's not mysterious at all and might be highly explainable, Don? Would that be okay?
Sure.
Apparently, this $22 million, CNN reported that most of the money went through a private aerospace company called Bigelow, that was run by a guy called Robert Bigelow, who was a close friend and longtime contributor of former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Was this whole thing maybe just a boondoggle?
I mean, I could see absolutely why that might be of concern to someone. But I think maybe the way to take a step back is that Robert Bigelow has long been a UFO enthusiast. And when you get right down to it, who would investigate possible UFO or extraterrestrial sightings except for an enthusiast? What I would like to see, though, so for any of your listeners who watched the X-Files back in the day, there was Fox Mulder, who was the sort of true believer, but there was Dana Scully, who was the very skeptical scientist. And so if in this effort they went about it the right way, with people who wanted to investigate it with sort of a positive mindset, but they also had an equal number of highly skeptical people working with them, I actually don't have a problem with that.
Well, Don, what is it about us? You've written about this. You hear UFOs. We see some grainy pictures of things. We don't know what they are right away. I mean, come on, 90% of us, we can't help it. 95% of us, we start thinking about aliens and alien invasion. Is this Hollywood? Why do we think this way?
Well, I mean, the whole idea of us not being alone is just in the universe is compelling. It's interesting. I mean, there's a heck of a lot of space out there. There are 100 or several hundred billion stars in our galaxy alone. And life formed here on our planet. We also know from true sober science that maybe people might have thought was crazy, that there are planets around stars near us. We know this. And there is a distinct possibility that life has formed out there. And in fact, I would bet money that life does exist elsewhere in the universe. Intelligent life is a lot harder. I actually talked about that in my book, the distinction between just life and intelligent life. But it's not at all shocking when you see something like this to think, well, you know, maybe it could be a visitor.
Well, many of us will think it could be a visitor. And if you work at the Pentagon, you might think, well, we better throw $22 million at it to find out. Don Lincoln, author of Alien Universe, Extraterrestrials in Our Minds and in the Cosmos. Don, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Aloha, this is Michelle calling from Honolulu. I have believed since I was a little kid that we couldn't possibly be the only planet in the universe that has life. It wouldn't surprise me to find that we are on the level of Stone Age or indeed bacteria in the eyes of civilizations advanced far beyond the imaginings of our most astute sci-fi authors.
Do you believe? 8778 My Take. Earlier this week, the International Dark Sky Association designated the very first dark sky reserve ever in the United States. It's one of only 12 in the entire world. This reserve in the U.S. is made up of 1,400 square miles in remote central Idaho. It's so dark that if you look up, you can see the Milky Way in all of its detail. John Barentine is the program manager for the International Dark Sky Association. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Well, John, when you stand out in the dark sky reserve in remote Idaho at 2 a.m. on a moonless night and you look up, what do you see?
You'll see something that you've probably never seen before in your life, especially if you come from the big city, and that is a sky full of stars from horizon to horizon. And you'll notice a lot more in the way of sounds on the ground because of the nocturnal wildlife that are active. And these are things that we're really disconnected from in many ways in many parts of the world because of the amount of light pollution that we live with now. So that's one of these things that sets Idaho apart and makes it very special.
John, I want to tell you a story that I experienced in the desert of Jordan one night many years ago, traveling 100 miles from any natural light, walked out of a Bedouin tent on a moonless night, probably for the first time in my life, a sky that dark. I was overwhelmed. I had never seen anything like that before. And the sense of remoteness in the universe that you get, the sense of not being central to anything, was really overwhelming. It was one of the most emotional moments I've ever had.
I'm not surprised to hear that. I hear stories like that from people who go to these extremely remote places, and they are almost disoriented because there are so many stars in the sky. And I think that's one of the most central and moving aspects of the experience, is that it really puts you in a very different frame of mind. And a lot of people report being very connected to nature when they have an experience like that.
Just how rare is dark sky today? You mentioned people who live in the cities, but even in the suburbs, having a dark sky is basically impossible.
We know from scientific studies using satellite data that something like about 80% of people in the world in one form or another are affected by light pollution directly and are unable to have the kind of experience that we've been talking about. So having places like the Dark Sky Reserve in Idaho makes that even further special because it's so relatively rare and it's so hard to find. But it also underscores the need to do as much as we can to try to protect those conditions.
Well, John, I don't know if you remember the very first time you found yourself in a place with a truly dark sky on a moonless night. Maybe you were a kid. Do you remember it? Do you remember the way it made you feel?
I do remember that, Todd. That was when I was growing up here in Arizona as a pretty young kid and seeing the Milky Way from around Flagstaff, Arizona for the first time. And having grown up in the big city, it was something that was just indescribable. I didn't even know that such a thing existed because it wasn't part of my everyday experience. And that is something that I think really motivates people to become involved in this somehow and to try to protect this. Once they have that experience, then they realize what we have lost by lighting up our cities the way that we have. And I think that's the real takeaway for a lot of people, is that it's possible to bring this back and to have that experience, but we need to prioritize it if we want that.
Well, John Barentine, I'll just say so many of us go through life every day, and it's understandable, feeling like we're the center of our universe. And the second you find yourself in a truly dark place with no moon and you look up, you realize what a fallacy that is. So thanks for your work, John.
Thanks, Todd. I appreciate the opportunity.
John Barentine, Program Manager for the International Dark Sky Association.
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You still don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
Oh, you just don't get it, do you?
Huh? You don't get it, do you?
Oh, I'm not taking that personally from the control room. Rafer, maybe they're talking about you.
I get it. I totally get it. I get it.
Rafer gets it. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Todd.
So, Rafer, you're here with a couple of movies today, Downsizing from director Alexander Payne. We're going to get right to this. I saw the trailer for this Matt Damon vehicle where they're shrinking people down, right, to solve, I think, the problem of overpopulation. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, this is the solution. I think this is going to lead to wacky places. I'm not sure. Here's a clip.
So the decision to...
Well, that's the thing. Downsizing takes the pressure right off, especially money pressure.
Well, and plus, it must feel good to know you're really making a difference.
You mean all that crap about saving the planet?
Yeah.
Downsizing is about saving yourself.
Matt Damon, I heard Jason Sudeikis in there. Kristen Wiig is in this one, too.
That's right. This little tiny Jason Sudeikis who's trying to convince him to take the plunge and go small, as they say. what's great about this movie is the premise is laid out so thoroughly, with such detail, that you just buy absolutely everything. Your teeth can't be shrunk, apparently, so they have to be removed and then little tiny ones reinstalled. What do you do with your wedding ring? What do you do with all your possessions, right? Fascinating premise. They lay it out so well.
You can't take it with you, in other words.
Yeah, that's right. Well, right. You can take much of it. And the great thing is, when you live in a very small world, the money that you have now goes a lot farther. So you can live in a giant McMansion and, you know, never have to worry about anything again. But once Matt Damon sort of goes into this little world, weirdly, the movie kind of runs out of steam, and it's got no story. It's got really nowhere to go. Christoph Waltz shows up as this kind of aging swinger guy. He's very funny. There's a new actress named Hong Chau who plays a Vietnamese house cleaner in this film. I'll be curious to see how that plays with people. The character is a little bit of a stereotype. It might offend some people. But anyway, you do have these two characters, but the story just never goes anywhere. So what you have is this massively great premise and not much of a story. So I found it a little frustrating.
And sometimes with these films, the premise for me is the most important thing. Does the logic of the premise see through to the end of the film, and does the conceit work for whatever kind of social commentary is at the base of it?
It totally does, and I will say this. The movie sends you out of the theater really thinking about things, about mankind, the future, what it means to live a life, what makes a life worth living. A lot of interesting things like that. So it's still very thought-provoking. I just found it, I wish the second half had been as brilliant as the first half.
All right, let's dive thoroughly into the world of realism, because Meryl Streep's in a new one called The Post from Steven Spielberg. Of course, I have to mention Tom Hanks is in it too, not just Meryl Streep. Let's listen to a clip.
So, can I ask you a hypothetical question?
Oh dear, I don't like hypothetical questions.
Well, I don't think you're going to like the real one either.
Do you have the papers?
Not yet.
Tom Hanks there is Ben Bradley of the Washington Post. Meryl Streep is Katharine Graham, two real people. The papers they're talking about are the Pentagon Papers. A lot of people have been mad about this because the Washington Post did not break the Pentagon Papers. The New York Times did.
That's correct. Although the Washington Post was the one who stepped up to the plate, along with some other papers, but the Washington Post stepped up to the plate after the New York Times was constrained from publishing them any further by Nixon's White House. And so it was this act of bravery to sort of buck that legal injunction and go ahead and publish. You know, you've got these two great actors on screen for the first time, remarkably. Streep and Hanks, you could hear in that clip how great they are. Really nice, crisp, tight journalism drama from Steven Spielberg. I'm a journalist. I love any drama that's set in a newspaper, so I'm a little biased, but I thought this was really great and obviously very timely.
You have to hold it up to movies like Spotlight or All the President's Men.
Exactly, right.
And does it hold up to those?
You know, I'm not sure I'd go so far as All the President's Men, although Tom Hanks does do a very good Ben Bradley, and you know, Jason Robards won the Supporting Actor Oscar for Ben Bradley back then, but Tom Hanks is very good in the role.
Well, Rafer, before we let you go, I know you're dying to give your review of Pitch Perfect 3. They've gone for three rounds with Pitch Perfect.
That's right. I think it's time to hang up the pitch pipe on this one.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I love the first movie. Who didn't love the first Pitch Perfect with Anna Kendrick? Number two, a little weaker, I think, at this point. Once you have a comedy that's got a sort of an espionage spy spoof in it, you know things are getting a little desperate.
Didn't work. Well, I'll probably avoid Pitch Perfect 3. If it were Pitch Perfect 2, I definitely would have been there. You know me.
I know you, Tom.
Yeah, can't get enough of that Pitch Perfect. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
For close to a year now, tens of thousands of mostly low-income students have wondered if the federal government is going to help them out after they were defrauded by a for-profit college company called Corinthian. The Obama administration, in its final days, moved to provide loan relief to students who got scammed at Corinthian colleges. Then the Education Department in the Trump administration, under Secretary Betsy DeVos, halted that program. Eileen Connor was on this program a few weeks ago. She's director of litigation at Harvard's Project on Predatory Student Lending.
Since January 20th, the administration has completely stopped processing these claims for relief from borrowers who were cheated and defrauded by schools like Corinthian and ITT Tech.
Well, now it appears there will be some relief for some defrauded borrowers, according to the Department of Education. Many others, it seems, may not get the help the federal government promised at all. Danielle Douglas-Gabriel is an education reporter for The Washington Post. Danielle, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been following this story for a while, Danielle. What's made the Education Department and Betsy DeVos reverse course here, at least partially?
Well, Education Secretary DeVos hasn't explicitly said this, but there are two new lawsuits that the department, as well as DeVos, is facing at this point. Attorney General in California filed a lawsuit last week, the same day as Massachusetts, with the help of New York as well as Illinois, decided to sue the department and DeVos for failing to process these claims, specifically for Corinthian College students. Now, Corinthian Colleges is the for-profit chain that closed a couple of years ago under allegations of steering students into predatory loans, lying to the government about its job placement rate, which is considered fraud. And all of that behavior was supposed to make it easier for students who attended these schools to receive loan forgiveness. In fact, the Obama administration, before leaving office, had promised group discharges of these loan forgiveness claims, essentially saying that, well, if you went to this school in this location where we found widespread evidence of fraud, well, we're going to make it easier for you to get loan forgiveness. Some people were able to take advantage of that, but a lot of other people weren't. And now a lot of folks are very concerned about the fact that those students who were promised discharges may not get them in full.
So how much relief is the Education Department providing here? Who gets their fraudulent loans forgiven and who doesn't?
So it's all on a sliding scale comparing the average earnings of students in similar vocational programs. So if you're an applicant, you may receive full loan forgiveness if your earnings are less than 50% of your peers. So let's say you attended a nursing program in California somewhere, a Corinthian program, and you're only making $50,000, where nurses in comparable programs elsewhere in the country on average earn, say, maybe $80,000 or $100,000. Well, you'd receive full relief because that's less than what the average is. But if you're making at or above that aggregated average, then the amount of loans that you get forgiven, the amount on your loans you get forgiven starts to decline. And a lot of consumer attorneys are questioning the legality of this, especially since the statute had said that if, you know, there was a finding of fraud, there would be full forgiveness. So I get a good sense that this may wind up in the courts. Mm.
And how has Betsy DeVos and the Education Department justified this sort of partial relief?
Well, you know, they are saying that there shouldn't be either full-fledged denial or full-fledged approval. That is not securing taxpayers' money, because essentially discharging these loans means that you're going to have to forgive in some cases, tens of thousands of dollars that can equal up to millions, if not billions, because many of these students who attended these programs took out as much as they possibly could in order to pay for them. A lot of them were not inexpensive programs. So we're talking about a lot of money that's on the line here. The trouble is, you know, when you have a previous administration promising widespread relief in instances where their own investigation found fraud, and you're not giving students the full amount of relief that they were promised, that could present a problem.
Danielle, there's another issue here besides loan forgiveness. There's the question of how much the federal government is doing to police and crack down on the type of fraud that Corinthian was involved in, along with other for-profit schools, allegedly, and stopping it in the first place. Listen to Harvard's Eileen Connor again here.
Where there are federal student aid dollars, there will be predatory actors. I think what we see, though, over time is this cycle of abuse. And they'll really take advantage of people like single mothers, first in their family to go to college, immigrants, veterans, and they'll leave them worse off than they found them, and they'll do it for profit. And it's something that has always been a problem, and I don't think any administration has really been great on protecting the public and students from these actors.
A cycle of abuse, Eileen Connor says. Are there any new actions in the Trump administration to stop this type of abuse in the first place?
Well, actually, what we're seeing is a proposed rollback of many of the regulations that were put in place in order to try to weed out these bad actors. The DeVos administration at this education department has tried to rewrite two very crucial rules that are supposed to kind of serve as a way to deter for-profit schools from engaging in the same bad behavior that many people had identified. One is called gainful employment. It is a rule that threatens to withhold federal student aid from a school if they consistently graduate students who have more debt than they can repay. DeVos has decided to hold off on fully implementing it and is convening a new panel to rewrite it. Another rule is called borrower defense repayment, which is at the crux of this Corinthian debt forgiveness issue. And she pretty much stopped it, the overhaul of that rule, from being put in place and is now rewriting it as well. The thing that's troubling, at least from a lot of consumer advocates and students who have gone to these schools, is that these rules were meant to, at the very least, just ensure that these schools are living up to the promises that they are giving students. If you're going to say that you can promise 78% job placement after I graduate from this program, well, prove it. And especially gainful employment is supposed to help ensure that schools are doing what they say.
And Danielle, we're going to let you go, but the bottom line here on loan relief for Corinthian, how many thousands of students are going to get some help? How many thousands left with no help at all? Do we know?
There are about 37,000 Corinthian students that are still waiting for their claims to be processed. The department pretty much said that it was going to effectively process 21,000, 12,000 of which will be approved, the remainder which will be denied.
Danielle Douglas-Gabriel with The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
He's been gone, well, be 18 years in March.
He would always have a smile on his face, just like everything was great. And you know, he was just dying inside.
It just seems like something's got to go wrong.
He's going to walk back out that door with us tomorrow, and we aren't going to be staying.
This will be it. Last time.
Hopefully, a big part of his life ahead of him.
It is going to be a ride.
This has been so long. I keep waiting for him to come get me.
We brought you down to Kentucky on Thursday for an update on Aaron Glasscock. We've been following Aaron since President Obama granted him clemency for nonviolent drug offenses after 18 years behind bars. It's part of our series called Commuted, Life After Prison. Takeaway producer Dana Roberson brings us back now to Aaron, who has a lot of support from friends and family. Still, adjustment to life on the outside hasn't been easy. After a mandatory 2 months in a halfway house, Aaron was finally able to move out and leave a life of rules and surveillance behind.
The day Aaron Glasscock left the halfway house felt a lot like the day he left prison.
Had my bags there, just sort of like ready to go.
I was out front waiting.
Jump in and burn rubber in case they change their mind. Go, 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 go.
Aaron's mom, Pigeon, drove him the 10 minutes to his new home. He moved in with just a few things.
This is the type of door I'm going to put in tomorrow for my cousin. And they're, you know, they're sort of rustic, too. So,
yeah, like a
grainy feel on them. I'm staying with my aunt, my mom's sister. My aunt Emma, I stay with her. We're like a block and a half from my cousin. And so, I mean, it's great here because I can see them. And this is my bedroom.
Bigger than your...
A whole lot bigger. I think the bed wouldn't fit in most of the rooms that I've been in. This is my white noise here. This is... So I turn that on every night, and that really helps me to sleep just because I'm so used to having so many noises around you. Then we got the dining room and the kitchen. I cook some. Usually it's in the microwave, but I'll cook eggs and stuff on the stove, and I've cooked a few things here and there.
Talk of cooking turns to Thanksgiving preparations. It would be Aaron's first one at home with family in 18 years.
Oh, my. We're potato getting rolls. Together. Potato rolls. Have you ever had potato rolls? The turkey, the dressing, homemade dumplings. I'm sure there'll be green beans there. We're going to have a variety, let me tell you.
I'll probably be laid out on the couch groaning from eating way too much.
Football.
And there will be football. Yeah, halftime doze.
Aaron has been in his aunt's house for nearly 7 months now. The adjustment has been slow and steady, but there is calm.
It's been great. You know, my brother would come in with my two nieces, his daughters and wife and my mom, and we'd go to the park and walk. So it's been great.
And there is no deadline for him to leave.
It says, I could stay here as long as, till I can get on my feet.
Done some work around, yeah. Around the house?
I got to pay my way.
Seeing how he's doing and how he's interacting, you can tell such a big difference from then and now, because you could tell, he was nervous and everything at the beginning, and he was watching what he said and, how he said it. It seemed like it was a kind of a struggle to have a conversation and everything. Worried, I guess, how people perceived him and everything. And now it's more like the old Aaron coming out, which I love seeing that.
After you've been on the inside, time is different when you're free. For Aaron, that's even more reason to take things slow.
I still have to be, cautious of not rushing stuff. And of course, I was turned down a few times because of my background, for some jobs that I was qualified for. I mean, I would get frustrated just because I know that I'm dependable. I've worked with, multi-million-dollar government contracts while I was, away. I mean, they didn't have a problem allowing me, to handle major contracts for the Department of Defense and for all the other federal government agencies. They didn't mind me having access to all that inside, so.
Inside prison, Aaron made $1.45 an hour. He now earns more in a day than he made in a month.
The job I have now is you've got material processing, cranes, aerial work platforms, and construction. And we deal with rock crushers and screeners. Got, like a small promotion already. The portion of the company that I deal with, they're factories or in Northern Ireland. So I'll be going over sometimes next year to Ireland as well. I've talked to my probation officer and see what's necessary. What do I need, to do for this to make sure I can get, my passport. They've been great to me.
And slowly but surely, he's been getting out, going to small concerts, seeing the city soccer team win a championship. He's even started dating.
And then here's my bike.
We walk outside to the garage where he keeps his new mountain bike.
What do you think about when you're riding?
Nothing. That's what I love to ride.
It's become one of his favorite activities.
It's nice to think about nothing, huh?
It's nice to think about nothing. Don't have to worry about, what anyone else is, thinking or saying, or worry about work or anything else. You just get on the trail and just ride and ride.
It's hard to think about nothing.
Yes, it is. But when your lungs and legs are burning, yeah, that takes your mind off everything else. You're just trying to focus on getting out of the woods.
He admits it's been hard to break some habits after 18 years.
I think I'm doing pretty good. I mean, there's times when I have, like, you know, flashbacks or something like that. Just, you know, going to the shower is a big one. And, you know, you go to the shower for 18 years and you've got, boots to the shower, and then you've got shower shoes you put on when you get there. Take your towel, your rag, and all your toiletries with you to the shower, and you bring them back. So having them already in the shower, I like get to the door of the room and I'm like, okay, I'm forgetting something.
And self-doubt lingers.
Some issues that you deal with, you know, I'm still not super social, so it's like, okay, well, is this normal? Am I, you know, distancing myself? Am I not, you know, being able to connect with people? I still have a feeling sometimes that I can't completely connect. But I've been doing all right otherwise. You know, I've got plenty of family, plenty of people that, you know, I can talk to.
And for Pigeon, Erin's homecoming has given her everything she needs for the holidays.
I don't care what kind of car I drive. Doesn't matter. It runs, it gets me there. I don't have to have new style shoes. It doesn't bother me. I'm just thankful just to get to have my kids, my grandkids, and my biggest blessing this year is getting to have Erin home or even just out. Having him free to go and ride his bike, if that's what he wanted all day, on the trails. If that's the way he wanted to spend Christmas, that would make me the happiest thing there ever was. Because as long as he's free, then, you know, everything's okay.
I'm Dana Roberson for The Takeaway.
You can hear more of Erin Glasscock's story on our website at thetakeaway.org/lifeafterprison. And that's all for our show today and the end of our week. We wish you wonderful and happy holidays. We'll be here on Monday on Christmas, so if you're at home with the family, you can definitely tune in. I hope you do. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.